Welcome to Stopgap Talks, your go-to podcast for expert insights into the marketing, digital, creative, and research recruitment landscape. With over 30 years of experience, our consultants are here to share the wisdom, strategies, and success stories that can transform your hiring or career journey. If you enjoy the episode, don't forget to subscribe, share, and leave a review to help others find us. Now let's dive in to the latest episode of Stopgap Talks.
Welcome to today's Stopgap podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Kate, one of the lead consultants here at Stopgap, and I'm delighted to say that joining us today is the lovely Catherine Ashmore. Catherine, tell us a little bit about yourself, would you?
Oh, hi, Kate. Thank you for asking me, first of all. It's lovely to be here. So my background is quite varied, but the common thread running through it has always been a deep curiosity about people, creativity, psychology, behaviour, and how we make decisions. And funnily enough, I was actually offered a place to study psychology for my first degree, but ended up going down quite a different path. My first real career was working for about 10 years, agency side in advertising, which is how I came across you in Stopgap.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I had the privilege of working in top global agencies. My clients were across many different sectors and many businesses. Mm. And I absolutely loved the mix of creativity, strategy, and understanding, you know, what makes people tick, especially during the rise of e-commerce and data-driven marketing. But, and there is a but, like many people in fast-paced roles, I also struggled. The hours were bonkers.
Yeah.
I was leading teams young. And on the outside, I looked like I had it all together, and I looked like I was doing well. But on the inside, I had crippling imposter syndrome, perfectionism, and the inner critic was shouting loud.
Okay.
So in effect, I was wearing a mask. And after about 10 years in the industry, I realized I was on the edge of burnout. And that was a big turning point. To either stay in the industry, which I loved, and set up my own thing, or retrain in my other passion, which was helping people. And so that's what led me into the medical arena, where I spent about 20 years as a healthcare professional before specializing within that as a musculoskeletal clinician for the last 18 years. And I served thousands of patients, both in the NHS and the private sector. And I loved coaching them in the process to take accountability for themselves and their next steps, not just physically, but mentally too. And I also set up my own business just before the pandemic hit. And it was during that time when it hit that I watched fellow clinicians, practice owners, entrepreneurs really struggle under the weight of uncertainty with very little support in the private sector, especially at the beginning on the front line. And so I set up a free support network with supported content, my own talks, coaching, mentoring, external speakers to help. And these people had navigated huge dramatic life changes. Some clinics had been shut, they'd had to start again, some were out of work, some weren't, some were at different life stages, different seniorities, different business sizes, different expertises. And so this space gave a non-judgmental private space for me to support them, but for also for them to be themselves and support each other. And the reason why I'm giving you this background, because that's when it all clicked.
Mm.
I'd been coaching in some shape or form my whole life, and it was part of my DNA. And after doing it pro bono for several years, I then set up my own coaching practice, and I'm also accredited. So I work as what's called a transformative coach with high-achieving entrepreneurs, leaders, and senior professionals. And as the word transformative suggests, my coaching is about creating lasting change in all facets of life. So how you show up in both life and in business. So I help the kind of people who were like I was, who look like they've got it all together on the surface, but underneath maybe juggling too many things, aren't tapping into what they're capable of and can't see the wood for the trees. And they might be held back by their own limiting beliefs or mindset.
Yeah.
So I help them to optimize what they're capable of. And there's a big difference, isn't there, between being capable and actually feeling confident.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, today's all about talking about the inner critic. Now,
yeah.
I would say I'm a total victim of the inner critic. But I think we need to be very clear for this podcast, exactly what is it is that we mean by the inner critic? Because as you said, there's lots of other things going around there, yeah, and imposter syndrome. And what does the term inner critic mean, Catherine?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's right to make the distinction. But before we start, I'd just like to say, before we go into this area, just a little caveat. We're going to be talking about some potentially quite sensitive things for the audience that are listening in. So if it ever feels like it's more than about a 4 out of 10 out of emotional intensity, where 10's high emotion, just leave this, come back to it later. Or if you feel that it is something you need to work on, and you can always contact me directly separately. But okay, so moving on to what is the inner critic? Well, all of us have that voice in our head, don't we? That voice that sits on our shoulder and questions us in different situations, that might say things like, I'm not good enough. And it often shows up when you're stretching yourself or doing something that matters, that you care about, like changing career, going for a new job, or speaking in front of a room full of people. And it's usually there. The reason why it's there is normally to protect you, to keep you safe from risk, rejection, or looking silly. But it's also important to say that sometimes it can be quite useful. It might give you that push you need to prepare better for an interview, or to check your facts, or to raise your standards, or to practice different scenarios of how you might answer a question. But when it moves into that harsh judgment space or self-sabotage, when it stops you from doing what you're capable of, or applying for that job, or for speaking up or showing up even, that's when it's no longer serving you. It's going from something that's like mild doubt to something that's dragging you down. And that's when we need to work with it, not to push it away, because we need to acknowledge that it's there, but just so that it doesn't take over and dictate how you're going to be, or let it run the show.
So is it prompted by change? I mean, I'm thinking the inner critic, it will often show up when you're on the job hunt, for example.
So
if you're just plodding along and not looking to make changes, directions, it might just sit quite dormantly, perhaps. But when you start looking for that job, whether because you feel you want to change, it's forced upon you because of redundancy, perhaps, that's when it can lift its nasty head.
Yeah, so I guess the question then is why? Why does it show up in job hunting, isn't it? So when it's dormant, it's normally either because you're in your comfort zone and you're not being challenged in a different way, or you've got other motivations which are driving you, so it's not foremost in your mind and you're getting good feedback. You've got a good sense of self and what you're doing.
Okay.
So the reason why it shows up in job hunting, because as I said before, you know, when you're feeling stretched in job hunting, you're often putting yourself out there, aren't you? Into unknown territories. You're going into places where you don't know what the feedback's going to be. And the inner critic just loves uncertainty. And when you're putting yourself out there, suddenly you've got this sort of spotlight on your identity and sense of worth, because you can feel that it's tied to how you're being perceived, whether it's on paper or whether it's on interviews, or even if you're met with silence. And even the most confident, capable people can feel wobbly in that situation, and their inner critic will say, hello, I'm here. So it's like natural in these situations also for it to stir up any past experiences or fears.
So what would some common inner critic scripts be that go on in the head, perhaps when we're in that job hunting phase?
One of the things I was going to mention actually about the job hunting thing is sometimes the inner critic goes really loud because you can't control who reads your CV or how they interpret it, or whether they're going to choose you, but you can control how you feel and how you react and how you show up. But that lack of clarity can often leave space for that inner critic to just jump in. And in the current climate, job hunting is, as you know more than I do, is really, really hard. You're not just writing your CV. You're trying to get past AI filters.
Absolutely.
And navigate the landscape, which can often include these vague rejections or silence or being gaslit by interviewers who suddenly change their tone, or being ghosted having gone through lots of different rounds. And so it can feel quite disorientating. And when that happens, the inner critic doesn't say, well, it's the system that's at fault, it's broken. Yeah. It often says, you're not good enough. And so I would add that it's normal to feel this way, but it's like, if you don't catch it, it can drain your energy and knock your confidence. So I guess the common scripts I would hear, or I think are quite human for people to feel, would be something like, I should have done better, or I'm not sure what they're looking for, or other people probably have more experience than me, or I should be further along by now, or what if I mess up? Maybe I'm not cut out for this because I've had so many knockbacks. Or quite often, this is my only shot. I can't afford to get it wrong.
Yeah.
And the most common one, as I said at the beginning, is I'm not good enough. And these thoughts often show up when you're already feeling under pressure.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you might be trying to stay positive, but just can't shake that sense of being judged. And what's important to say is these thoughts don't mean you're not capable. And quite commonly, they get loud in people who are competent because they care.
Was going to ask, Catherine, is it right to think, as I perhaps thought, that the inner critic is more common to females than males, or they say it's more common in the high achievers? Is that a very broad statement, or is that what the...
I think there's I think there's some truth in that. It's not that women or high performers are the only ones who get the inner critic. We all have one to some degree. But it's true it can show up more strongly or more frequently in certain groups. And that feeling of self-doubt has been explored a lot in research. And, you know, going back to the term imposter phenomenon or imposter syndrome, that was researched back in the late 70s. And the reason I mention it is because it was a thing that was really dominant in high achieving women. So it did a massive study. So the idea of self-doubt, the idea of the inner critic, has been known about in women for quite a long time. And for many women, the inner critic can be layered with extra pressure. You know, research and reports, workplace reports, show that women often face higher scrutiny. They have fewer role models in senior positions. They receive less encouragement to take risks or to assert themselves. And if they do assert themselves, they can be perceived as aggressive. And rightly or wrongly, this is what's going on in the world. I'm not here to make a political agenda statement, but it's a common thing that I hear. And alongside this, there's that societal context or messaging, like you need to be likable or having to get things just right. Therefore, you over prepare. And over time, this gets internalized. And this means when women stretch themselves or do something new, the inner critic might say things like, don't be too confident or you're going to get knocked back. Who do you think you are?
Right. Yes.
And for high performers, the inner critic works differently, but it can be just as intense. And the environments that high performers work in often come with a culture of perfectionism where, you know, you have that expectation that everything has to be whiter than white and just perfect.
Yeah.
No one can be perfect all the time. So there's that, those feelings of self-doubt, fear of failure, imposter syndrome, those are all common in high achieving environments because people tie their worth to achievement. And therefore the inner critic pushes them to do more, to be more, and never mess up. And if they do, it shouts really, really loud, the inner critic. So the tricky part, I guess, for both groups is they often have to look together on the outside.
Yeah.
So it's about really keeping in mind that you need to acknowledge that you might be feeling that without feeding the self-doubt or overthinking. Otherwise, that leads to burnout. Sorry, that was quite a long talk there.
Yeah, but no, I was going to say, I mean, it would be absolutely exhausting. So it's like everything, it's about keeping that balance and just keeping an eye on yourself and a self-awareness, isn't it? Which is easier said than done. But as we said, we'll talk through things and then hopefully we can gather up some takeaways or some key tools at the end of this conversation. You get to an interview stage. The inner critic can manifest itself sort of visually as well as in the conversation. How might it present itself when you're in an interview?
Yeah, I think that's very relevant, actually, because it's very different if you're being interviewed in person to being interviewed online.
Right.
And it can impact performance to a huge degree in both. And when that voice is loud, the doubt and anxiety can make it harder to stay present or articulate yourself in the way that you want to get yourself across. And it can encourage overthinking or second guessing, or being caught up in what if scenarios rather than being there in the moment. So on video calls like Teams,
yeah,
it can be a bit trickier because often there's less non-verbal feedback. And what I mean by that is normally you get more cues in person in real life. And so you can't always see how you're being received by the non-verbal cues you would get, you know, either facial expressions, more body language or things like that. And also there can be more awkward silences with the pressure of technology glitches. And I've heard of all sorts of different distractions on panel interviews where not all people will be attentive. And that, if you're seeing multiple faces on a screen where you're being interviewed, that can be quite distracting and hard on the candidate.
Very.
And these can amplify nerves. So you might also have to think about, well, how am I looking on camera and am I coming across well, which can pull attention away from what you're actually saying. And we will talk about tools later.
It's not as natural, is it, on the screen?
No.
Yeah.
No. And in face-to-face interviews, it's slightly different because you get into the room, you can read the room, you can read the interviewer's body language and manage physical presence.
Mm.
But the inner critic will work in a different way because you might feel more self-conscious in the room and it might cause you to feel held back rather than fully own your power. So I guess in both settings, if it takes over, you might demonstrate hesitation, maybe be less confident in your answers, and therefore you're missing opportunities to connect. And that can impact the impression you leave. But having said all those negatives, awareness is really, really key. Because if you're aware that this might happen, that's really powerful in itself, because you know when the inner critic is shouting, you will recognize it, take the chance to pause, reframe the situation, we'll talk about that a bit later, and bring your focus back to where you want to or what you want to share. Does that make sense?
So the
brain, the way the brain works is it believes what you tell it. So if your inner critic is feeding your brain a steady stream of statements like, I'm not good enough, I'm going to mess this interview up, someone else is probably better than I am, your brain is going to start to treat those thoughts like facts. And that then leads you subconsciously, that will shape your feelings, how your body responds in the situation and how you show up. But the good news is you can also choose what to tell your brain. So you can choose to tell your brain different thoughts, different stories, more helpful ones that will support your confidence and focus before you go into that interview room or online meeting.
It's like exercising the brain and the thoughts just as much as you might exercise the body, isn't it?
Yeah, there's something called neuroplasticity. I do mention it quite a lot on my socials and things because it is, I think if people understand the concept, it's just like, oh, that makes so much sense. And what it is, as I said, your brain believes what you tell it. So if you're telling it negative thoughts, then it's going to connect lots of nerves and neural pathways to encourage those negative thoughts. And then you're going to be taking actions that support those negative thoughts. But when you start telling yourself, even if you don't believe it yet, when you start telling yourself, oh, I know I'm really good at this because, when you start telling yourself confident statements about yourself that you know to be true, when you tell yourself, if you tell yourself how you want to come across and what traits might be required, I need to sit still, I need to have good eye contact, I need to stand assertively, or I need to sit assertively and look attentive. If you're telling yourself these things before, your brain's going to rewire itself to tune into those. And the more you practice that way of thinking and positive mindset, the feedback loop creates more confidence and more positive, grounded, attentive results. And it's not something that just happens overnight. It's something that happens with practice.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So as I said, the brain isn't able to differentiate between what's real or what's not with what you tell it. So if you tell it, I want to be successful, I want to be XYZ, it's going to believe it. And if you say it enough, it will start putting in neural pathways to help you sustain that. Wow. So some people think, I will never be able to get rid of the inner critic.
Yeah.
But if you start practicing this positive mindset, and that's not to be confused with positive toxicity.
Okay.
Positive toxicity is something where you just put a face on the whole time and pretend to be okay. I'm this, I'm that, and totally ignore what else is going on. That's a form of avoidance.
Okay.
Positive mindset is where you're still acknowledging that things might be difficult, but you're taking action anyway.
Yeah, like that. And presumably it's also about being realistic, you know.
Yeah.
I can't tell myself I'm going to be an Olympic gymnast and enough times that it's going to happen. So we can't make the impossible possible through that, can we?
Yeah. But
yeah, okay. And what about, so you're having your interview with your potential boss, employer. Do they recognise that there's an inner critic going on with somebody in an interview, or do they just think, well, that's the way they are? Do you think they're tuned into this?
I think it really, really varies, doesn't it? There's so many cultural differences, and it depends on the person. I think, you know, a lot of people, we all have the inner critic, so I'd like to hope that people would recognise certain traits. But for anyone who's listening who might be interviewing anyone, I can certainly talk through things to recognise if it's not an area they feel confident in. So I guess you could pick up on how it shows up in interviews, and even if it's subtle, and your candidates might be hesitating a lot. There might be a lack of eye contact. They might be being overly cautious in their answers, or seeming to be less engaged or confident, which seems not in keeping with what the paperwork or their experience would suggest.
Yeah.
So sometimes it can come across as nervousness or uncertainty. And unfortunately, that might make the interviewer think, oh, how does the candidate cope under pressure or fit confidently within the team? And this is where I guess the interviewer's own inner critic or unconscious bias can impact how they interpret these signals.
Right.
So if they've misread nerves as a lack of competence or enthusiasm, it can work both ways. And both the candidate and the employer can both have their own inner critics influencing the interaction without realizing it. So I think it's about how it's not just about managing it personally. It's about thinking, what's going on here as the interviewer? Are they, you know, taking a moment? And it's a tricky dynamic.
Yeah.
And I also think in the current climate, there needs to be an element of compassion. And
you mean
setting
the
up
current climate, sorry, Catherine, in which it's a tough market.
Yeah.
Particularly.
Yeah. So I think quite commonly by the time people get to interview, they might have been through several stages or, you know, just found it tricky. Not everyone, but sometimes.
Yeah.
And this might have been the first time they got through to the stage in ages. So they're feeling a lot of pressure. So I think psychological safety is really, really important. And what I mean by that is it's also, I feel, responsibility of the interviewer to create a space where the interviewee can feel comfortable. But also when they're talking, to give them that space and talking to allow the employee, potential employee, to have space to ground themselves, to collect their thoughts. But also to have a nice warm environment, you know, keep it quite relaxed and give them that time if they need it. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. And I think the way interviews are treated, you know, by some potential employees, it's a sort of, we're going to test them, see what they can take in this interview. Others, it's much more welcoming. We recognize you as a human being, not just a potential person to be working. It's treated very differently by different companies. I think you were telling me about a very bizarre scenario when we were chatting a few weeks ago, and I'll let you tell the story, but I'm not sure what the purpose of that, what the challenge was that they were trying to bring up.
I think in certain cultures there's this thing, what I would call, rightly or wrongly, I hope I don't get shouted about this, but I call it old school tactics, not necessarily current thinking tactics, where sometimes people like to do disruptive things in an interview to see how an interviewee will behave under pressure.
Yeah.
And I think in the current climate, I don't think that's particularly helpful, because you're potentially missing out on very, very good, experienced candidates. There was an incident that I'm thinking of, where it was a panel interview, and one of the panel was on a treadmill.
I mean, panel interviews are tough enough as it is.
Yeah.
Can you
imagine how distracting that would be for a candidate, where they've got several people to navigate, to look at the screen, and then one of them, they can't read the body language or how people are receiving them to get their cues.
So this is on and Teams?
Then, yeah.
Okay.
And one of them's on a treadmill. it's just, I think as a company, you've got to think, what is the image and brand that I'm giving out?
Yeah.
Because even if they're a candidate, your behavior, it's a two-way street. Your behavior also impacts and will make an impression on people that you're interviewing.
Yeah.
And they have their own networks.
Of course.
So, yeah. So going back into that, when we're thinking about reframes, owning your power in an interview isn't about arrogance. It's about recognizing that this is a two-way conversation. So in that situation, you're not just being assessed, you're also assessing if this role and company fit you.
Dead right.
Now, some people might think, oh, that's really cool. I like a company where they're so relaxed that they can do this, and that might work for them. And that there's no judgment there. But when you go into an interview and you're fighting that inner critic, when you step into that mindset and think, it's also about I have power in this as well as the other one, without being arrogant, it's a two-way conversation. It then shifts the energy. So instead of shrinking back or trying to fit the mold that you think the culture of who you're being interviewed by is, you bring your full self.
Yeah.
Your strengths, your values and boundaries to the table. And then that confidence shows up in your tone and your body language and your choices, which the interviewer can pick up on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm terrible for saying to candidates that I'm working with and they've got to an interview stage, obviously we'll prepare for the interview, who they're going to be meeting, reiterate the key aspects of the role itself. But I'm terrible for saying, just be yourself, which sounds quite easy, but you've got to be true to yourself and reflect yourself. And if you're trying to fit into their box too much and it's not really the most comfortable box for you, it's not going to work long term, is it? So
absolutely. No, I completely agree with that, Kate. I think, you know, when you think about the importance of, you know, you spend a lot of time in your work environment and you want to work with people that you feel you can be yourself. Otherwise, you're not going to show up fully. You're not going to be able to give into the job that you want to have. And you'll be wearing a mask potentially. Mm. So when you think about it as a two-way thing, it then takes the pressure off trying to be perfect. And then you can be yourself and be intentional. And you're also signaling that you respect yourself and think, is this the right fit for me?
Yeah.
And that changes the interview from a test to being a genuine conversation.
Absolutely. I mean, I love that, Catherine, because again, that it's you're meeting them to see if they're right for you. It's not just about are you right for them? So I'm conscious of time. We could talk about inner critic for a lot longer, but we're keen to give some useful tools and insights for people before we conclude our conversation. Just from a consultant's point of view here at Stopgap, I would say, whilst we are not transformation coaches like yourself, Catherine, for example, I might receive a CV, then have a conversation with that candidate. The CV has got half the information that I'm receiving when I have a conversation with that candidate. I think it's very easy for people to not really appreciate what they have done, what they've achieved, and because they've been doing it, it's all in their head, but to an outsider, or some people don't think they've necessarily achieved that much and they don't think it's worth putting onto their CV. And I think some of that might be the inner critic coming through as well, because it doesn't sound that great, is that right? So you don't always recognize your full value or your full potential. So I would hope that we as consultants can have a genuine conversation, because the idea is when you're talking to us is you can be completely honest. Yeah, this is what I'm good at, Kate. I'm not so good at that. This is what I love. They wanted me doing more of that. I did it, but it wasn't really me. It didn't give me joy. So I want them to feel that they can be honest with us. We're not saying that everybody can do everything, but I would hope that that would give them a bit more confidence when they're demonstrating their skill sets. And then we find the right sorts of roles for them, not just because it looks good on paper or it's a nice job title. It's genuinely the right role for them. From your perspective, are there some key things we should be telling ourselves, helping ourselves with, not doing when the inner critic starts tapping on the door during our job hunting?
I totally agree with what you were saying, by the way, Kate. I also think it's important sometimes to add onto that, we all forget what we've done.
Yeah.
So sometimes you have to actually go through stuff and remember what you've done to remember how it fits in.
Yeah.
But in terms of, so I talked about the importance of how you speak to yourself. So no, I think the important thing about managing inner critic is not to deny that it exists. It's there for a reason. Either it's telling yourself, oh, I need to, you know, pull up my socks, gird my loins and really perform, and that's great.
Okay. Or,
but it's when it's going into that harsh self-sabotage side that it's negative. And so it's really important, I think, to practice self-compassion. And when I hear those words, because just because of the type of nature that I am, I want to make clear that it's not about being soft and a fluffy airy fairy. Yeah. This is about showing yourself kindness.
Yes.
Be kind to yourself in a situation. It's tough changing jobs. These are big stressful times, you know, big moment crossroads in life when you're moving jobs. It is. So be kind to yourself and think, how would I talk to a friend if they're in the same situation like me? That's a real big one.
Yeah.
And it's recognizing that it's often a scared part of you trying to keep you safe. And compassion helps reduce that shame loop. And the other thing is to name it. Give it an identity.
Your inner critic.
Yeah.
Do you mean like Henry or Fred?
Yeah. Or you know, that pesky inner critic, the judge, or that nasty voice. And when it pipes up, if you've given it identity, it almost separates it slightly and think, you want to catch that inner critic, you want to listen to what it's saying, and then think, is what it's saying true? Where's the evidence for it? And that is a massive reframe. So you know, what's another way of looking at this? It's about shifting the narrative.
Yeah.
And the other thing that can really help is what we call confidence anchoring, which is when you look at real live examples of what you've done to succeed.
Okay.
Even if they weren't perfect, doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And write down a list of moments where you've succeeded, where you've demonstrated really well what that job is entailing that you're going for.
Okay.
And so when if you write that list, when you're having those moments where the self-critic, inner critic is piping up, you can look at that. But also, sometimes you need to have body-based awareness, because when the inner critic's loud, your nervous system is as well.
Body-based awareness.
Yeah. Okay. So grounding techniques like breathing techniques can control your breathing and help settle the body, especially useful before interviews. But the big one, conscious of the time, is visualization. So like I said before, the brain believes what you tell it.
Right.
So if you literally rehearse in your brain how you're going to behave, how you're going to talk, what you're wearing, what senses, what light is going to be in the room, is there going to be a desk? Have you got the screen in front of you? How's your desk laid out?
Yeah.
What questions might come up? How are you going to answer them? If you visualize that beforehand in your head, using as many senses as possible, it's practicing the brain in a non-high stakes environment, so that when you are in a high stakes environment, it's then much easier to go into the situation feeling more calm and more confident.
You're ready.
Yeah. As well as obviously practicing different stories that you think will be helpful to say in the interview, and practice in front of the mirror. You could practice body language in front of your screen if you're aware of things like that. These are little techniques that can help.
Talking out loud. Can we chat?
Yeah.
I find myself talking out loud to myself with my thoughts.
Yeah. And other things, positive statements like affirmations. Affirmations, basically positive statements which literally negate the inner critic. So if you said to yourself, I'm a rubbish leader, that would be an inner critic.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had a statement and put it on a post-it note and on the mirror and read it every day saying, I am good at what I do, I'm going to get the job I deserve, I'm confident, I'm great at speaking, I'm going to be articulate, I'm going to be calm, you're telling your brain what it needs to be.
Yeah.
And that there is science behind it.
Right.
So as I said before, when you name that inner critic, you're naming it, but you're not going to be it. So most people realize that the voice in their head is not the truth. It's a protective part of them trying to keep them safe from rejection or risk. So when you name it, as I said, it helps create that bit of distance.
Yeah.
And once you can spot it, then you can start to choose how much power you give it. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Those are a few tips.
Well, it sounds so simple.
I could tell loads more.
Well, I think on that point, we've highlighted the topic of the inner critic. We've skimmed the surface, started exploring a little bit more, and hopefully we've demonstrated that it's very typical, it's very common, it is normal, it can have positives, because to me, before this conversation, inner critic was an absolute negative, Catherine, but you have demonstrated there are some good aspects of your inner critic. It keeps you on your toes, it can keep you moving forward, but as you said, it's when it shifts into that negative self-sabotage, almost self-bullying voice, that's when you've got to recognize it and start making some changes. And you've given us some initial tools on how we should be and could be doing that. So thank you.
My pleasure. I was just going to say just a couple two-line mindset shifts, which can really help.
Mm.
You don't have to believe every fear you hear or feel.
Mm.
And the second one is, fear doesn't define what's possible.
No. Yeah, so believe in ourselves and be nice to ourselves.
Yes, absolutely.
And you can still go forward. Okay, I'm going to hold on to that. I'll put some of those into practice. I'm going to find a name for my inner critic. That's going to be my first thing to do. Catherine, thank you so much. If people want to hear more about you and your skills and experiences and guidance, I know you certainly do your own podcast. Where can people follow you?
Well, the easiest thing is I'm on social media under my name. And also, if you're interested in finding out more, my website is katherineashmore.com.
Okay.
I'm also doing a masterclass or a training on some of these areas, actually. It's on mastering your mindset on the 17th of June. So I can give you the link, and if people are interested, they could sign up to that.
Fantastic.
So yeah, I'm on the socials under my name, Instagram and LinkedIn.
Okay.
And then there's my website as well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh,
it's been great.
Absolute pleasure, Catherine. I've loved our chat. I've certainly learned things myself. And I do hope that listeners today have gathered up some insights and it's made them think about things perhaps they hadn't before, or certainly we've been discussing things that they have been thinking of and needed a bit of direction. So thank you so much for your time, and I'll no doubt speak to you again, and have a lovely weekend.
You too. Thanks very much. My pleasure.
Cheerio. Bye.
Bye.